I've been asked to comment briefly on the Marcyites, and some of the younger comrades are wondering who these people are, or what they are, or where they came from, and so forth and so on, because of their tendency towards anonymity. We characterize the Marcyites as a cult. I can't remember in which document Jim Cannon analyzes cultism. It was in an article in the magazine. Can't remember which one it was. Anyway, it was like a small family with the paternal grandfather or father image in Marcy. I remember Marcy when I was organizer in local New York in 1945, I believe. He was in the Brooklyn branch. He was a lawyer, originally a lawyer. And some of the comrades were active in the paper workers union in Brooklyn. And he got into the union first through his legal, through the fact he was a lawyer, then became an official of the union. And the entire group was there in Brooklyn. And he used to herd them around like they were his little chicks. You know, nobody could get prices. He'd go out there occasionally for a fraction meeting. And I would marvel at the relationship between Marcy and his little group. There's a tendency towards cultism manifest even as long ago as that. Later he went up to Buffalo. We started a little branch in Buffalo through Copeland, Vincent Copeland, who used to be an actor, and then went into a steel plant in the Buffalo area, and began to attract a little group around him. In the meantime, this whole business in the paper workers blew up. There was a big overturn in the leadership and the purge, and Marcy was out. I can't remember why he went to Buffalo, but maybe the party sent him there to try and form a little branch in Buffalo, in which the same sort of relationship was established. Politically, the first time their tendencies began to develop any kind of a defined political position, if my memory serves me, is when they submitted a document called the Global Class War. It was an outgrowth of the big discussion we had in beginning with 46, 47, and going on continuously until the Third World Congress in 51 over the class character. That's the Third World Congress Report International. The class character of the East European states, in which he developed this concept that what we were confronted with was a global class war in which there were two class camps. Not three or four, but two. And you determined your attitude towards the various state formation by determining which class camp they were in. There was the class camp around the Soviet Union, this was even prior to the Chinese Revolution. And after the Chinese Revolution, of course, China was part of this class camp. Around the Soviet Union, the Soviet bloc, that was one class camp. The second class camp was the capitalist camp. The concept was that Stalinism in power equaled workers' states. So that in China, he says, there was a workers' state established in 1949. That is, at the time of the Chinese Revolution, which was a departure from the criteria that we had arrived at throughout the whole period of this lengthy discussion on the class character of the East European states. And there again, you see, as I say, it was a very complex and very complicated phenomena, and it took place over a lengthy period of time. And it was part of an extended process, so that the development of our positions actually followed the changes in the relationship between the Soviet Union and the state and of their economic form. We had gone through a sort of a preliminary discussion with the Shachmanites in 1940, over, you remember, over the class question, the class character of the Soviet state. They said it was Burnham said it was bureaucratic collectivism. Later, after they split, they adopted the bureaucratic collectivist concept as their official line. They didn't do it while they were inside of the SWP. And then they came out for the so-called third camp position. Also a schematic that there were three camps. There was the Soviet Stalinist camp, there was the capitalist camp, and then there was a third camp in the middle, the anti-Stalinist social revolutionist camp, presumed. Our criteria during that debate with the Shachmanites over the class character of the Soviet Union was developed by the old man, by Trotsky. And it was based primarily on the fundamental tenets of Marxism. Our point of departure was the question of the economy. The old man pointed out that what was decisive in determining our characterization of the Soviet Union as a degenerated workers' state was that they had overthrown capitalist property forms and relations and had established nationalized property. And the monopoly of foreign trade. And a planned economy. Now, these were the basic conquests of the October Revolution. These were the basic criteria which determined our continuation, that is, the continued necessity for us to defend the Soviet Union against imperialist attack. And we said it was these, despite the political degeneration that had taken place under Stalinism, that determined for us the class character of the Soviet Union. Now, we went into the East European discussion with this prior experience, the previous experience of the discussion with the Shachman. We said, now how does the criteria that we established in the original discussion, how does it fit here? Well, originally it didn't fit. It didn't fit in 1945 or 46 under the coalition government because they maintained capitalist property relations and announced their determination to continue, as the Chinese did. That they established coalition governments, artificially created, and maintained capitalist property relations. Now, after 46, with the outbreak of the Cold War, and the elimination of the overthrow of the coalitions were just booted out, because they had no real substance to them, transformations began to take place in the property forms and the property relations. But it wasn't at all clear, because it wasn't like, say, the Bolsheviks did in Russia. They said, now we issue a whole series of decrees. We nationalize the land, and all property, and institute a planned economy on a basis. That's not the way it happened. It happened gradually and over a period of time. So we said that these states were not altogether capitalist because they had ousted the coalition government, they had begun the transformation, yet they did not conform to the criteria that we had established for determining that they were deformed or degenerated working states. So that's how the dispute developed. And it wasn't, as I say, until 1951, the Third World Congress, that the resolution was finally adopted on a world scale, establishing the designation of deformed worker states for these states. And by that time, of course, all of the prerequisites had already taken, had obviously been accomplished, as they all had proceeded along the line of the collectivization, socialization of the means of production, abolishing the property of capitalist property forms and property relations. Now we applied the same criteria to the question of China in the Chinese discussion. China, for a long time, maintained a coalition, an artificial coalition, again, with a number of capitalist parties, and openly proclaimed they had no intention of altering the property forms or property relations. That they would remain capitalist, and they did. So there again, we were confronted with a phenomenon where a Stalinist leadership in power, resting upon the control of the armed forces and based upon an economy of essentially capitalist in character. He said this was not a deformed worker state because it had not altered its property forms and property relations in conformance with our basic criteria. So it wasn't until during the Korean War, and because of the exigencies of the Korean War, that the Chinese were compelled to abandon their previous maintenance of the capitalist property relations and begin more or less rapid transformation, nationalization, and the planning of their economy, because it became absolutely necessary for them to do so in order to carry out the war in Korea. It was after that we define China as a deformed worker state. Now, we had a big argument with the Marxists over this question, both in East Europe and in China, in which, on the basis of their schema of the global class struggle and the two-camp concept, that you had to be either in one camp or another, they said that these states became worker states immediately the Stalinists took power in China and in Eastern Europe. Now, those of you who will have read I've gotten hold of this, Wolfers's lucubrations on the, what does he call it? Structural assimilation. We'll be struck by the similarity in the positions between Marxite and Wolfers, although in Wolfers it's much more obscure. See, he has two criteria, too. There are only two ways in which a worker state can be established. That's either through an extension of the Kremlin, the influence of the Kremlin, or the agents of the Kremlin, or the classical way of the October Revolution. These are the only two ways. And then he goes on to say, well, all of these states contiguous, all the states in the Soviet bloc contiguous to the Soviet Union are extensions of the Kremlin bureaucracy and therefore can and should be designated as worker states. And China also. See, it's a similar schema. But then you come to Cuba, you see. Well, he resolved that question by eliminating Cuba entirely from his argument. He says, we'll pick this up later, you see, Cuba. Because Cuba is not contiguous to the Soviet Union. It certainly is not an extension of the Kremlin bureaucracy. especially now since the Escalante is there. Therefore, what is it? What is Cuba? Well, they'll say it's a transitional state. Yeah, I know, but transitional from what to what? At what stage is it now? It nationalized its property? It's expropriated the capitalist? It abolished the capitalist forms of production and capitalist property relations? It has a planned economy and a monopoly of foreign trade. So what is this animal, you see? It can't be structural assimilation. 4,000 or 5,000 miles from the borders of the Soviet Union. But anyway, that's his problem. The Marxite approach is much simpler, much more direct and less crooked. They set two camps, either one camp or the other, and you got to take your choice. Well, there was no problem with them so long as these questions remain more or less academic, or so long as we agreed, we both arrived at the identical political conclusions. That is, what political conclusions do you derive from your analysis? And why do we go through all of this business about years of discussion over such questions? Our political conclusion is necessary to defend these states against imperialist attack, even though they were deformed workers' states. In the case of the Soviet Union, degenerated workers' states. Well, let me just say a word about the difference between degenerated and deformed, which Wolfert also makes a good point about. See, the distinction we make is that in the Soviet Union, you began with a healthy workers' state. You began with the Soviets under Lenin and Trotsky and the Bolshevik Party. And you had a degeneration take place under Stalinism, after Stalinism took power in the Soviet Union. So from a healthy workers' state, you had a degenerated workers' state. But these other states were never healthy to begin with, you see. Most of them came about not through the results of a classical revolution of the October kind, either through the invasion of the Red Army or, as in China, through a guerrilla, large-scale guerrilla peasant operation. So we say, not having been healthy workers' state, they certainly couldn't have degenerated. So we designate them as deformed, deformed from their very start. And that's the only distinction we make between deformed and degenerated workers' state. Now, I say, so long as we arrived at the identical political conclusions, there was no problem about coexisting in the same organization. That is, we were both for defense of the, regardless of what you call it, regardless of how you arrived at your conclusion, whether it was on the global class concept or on the basis of our Marxist criteria or any other criteria, so long as we agreed on the necessity of defending these states against imperialist attack, we could coexist in the same front. But in 1956, a revolution occurred in Hungary. And the question is, what would our political conclusions be as a result of this revolution? Well, on the basis of their global class camp concept, the Marxists arrived at the conclusion that this was a counter-revolution in Hungary. And therefore, we should support the suppression of the revolution by the Soviet tanks and by any other method. Our line was that it was a revolution, the political revolution, if any classical form of the political revolution had arisen in the whole period, it was the one in Hungary. And that it was a necessity for us to defend the revolution against the counter-revolutionary actions of the Stalinists, both in Hungary and the Soviet Union. Well, there you see, we arrive at divergent political conclusions from what appeared to be an abstract or academic discussion over the determination of the class character of the state. And it became increasingly impossible to coexist in a single organization. because the question is, what do you say publicly? So you come out in a militant in a magazine which kept hammering away at the necessity of defending this revolution of the workers of the world, intervening, however possible and if possible, in defense of this revolution. Now they, on the other hand, were smarting under this restriction imposed by our concept of organization, democratic centralism, which did not permit them to come out publicly and support the intervention on the part of the Kremlin, the crushing of the revolution, the characterizing it as that counter-revolution. Well, it was at that point when it became obvious to many of us that our coexistence in a common organization wasn't long for this world. You cannot. This was the question of revolution. You find yourself, figuratively speaking at least, on opposite sides of the barricade. It becomes very, very difficult to belong to a common organization where you have such completely divergent views on such a question as a revolution. So then they began developing differences on all kinds of questions after that, but this was the essential thing on regroupment, on poor Carlos Lamont. They just hated poor Carlos Lamont, who was a candidate for the ISP in 1958. You're a harmless sort of a jerk. I never had much feelings about him one way or another. He's no better, no worse than any of those people around me. But they hated poor. They used to belabor old Carlos Lamont by the hour at the ranch meeting. And finally, one day, they just walked out. Just, I think it was 2 months before the convention. Or before the opening of pre-convention discussion. Yeah, just at a very short time before we were supposed to open a pre-convention discussion in which they would have the opportunity of presenting their view to the entire party, they just walked out one night. Along with one of their major recruits, Julie, what is his name? The taxi driver? Julie something or other, who was one of their leaders, but to who they didn't permit to enter the new organization because he developed a difference with Marcy. You can't live in that organization very long if you have a difference with a cult leader. So they said that they hadn't accepted his membership. That was what the driver said, that they hadn't accepted his membership, therefore he wasn't even a member of the new group that they had set up. And so he was ousted. Well, then the next test that came along was the Cuban Revolution. What do you have here? Obviously, you didn't have Stalinists in power. What was this? Well, all they did is apply their test to the global class camp. Which camp was Castro in? He was not in the Soviet camp. He was in the capitalist camp. Therefore, he was a capitalist. And they characterized him, warned the workers against him. Now, in their first issue, this is volume 1, number 1 of Workers' World, to show how much more revolutionary they were than the SWP, they put Lenin and Trotsky's picture on their masthead. Now, the militant used to carry Lenin and Trotsky's picture on its masthead for many years. There was Brightman or somebody who once raised the objection. He says, these names, they're foreign to American workers. They don't know who these people are, Lenin and Trotsky. And even having them on the masthead of an American paper, it raises all sorts of questions. Oh, you're some little sectarian grouping, you know. So we had a discussion now. We decided to take Lenin and Trotsky off. They put them back on. That was to show how revolutionary they were. Then, here they have Trotsky's red, the white, Trotsky and Boris Pasternak. Which side are you on? Well, the guy said, global class camp, you apply that, you know immediately which side you're on. I don't know what the issue is about Pasternak here. Somebody, Yuri Andreyevich, had no rifle or something. Oh, here it is. Will Castro solve the problems of the Cuban workers and peasants? So this is by Sam Marcy. This is March 1959. Quote, Castro is a Caribbean imitation of the Nasser Nehru prototype. This is a more or less militant bourgeois nationalist type, capable of temporary, unreliable opposition to imperialism under the pressure of the revolutionary masses. The leaders of this type are supposed to be neutral, in quotes. That is, neutral in the diplomatic aspects of the struggle of the Soviet bloc against imperialism. You see, the two-class camp. But they are not neutral in the class struggle. We shall not have to wait for Castro to assume the personal dictatorial powers of Batista before he attempts to discipline the whole labor movement. He has already removed the top CP leaders from the Trade Union Federation. It's a very bad sign, you see. And he will not have to grope very long to find methods to do this. The hypocritical pacifist, in quotes, Nehru, and the, quote, neutral nationalist Nasser have already shown him the way, you see. He was already warning against the taking any action against the CP leaders. Then, there you have, the proletarian left wing of the SWP split and called for return to the road of Lenin and Trotsky. Document, they have the section, bourgeoisie led Hungarian masses in a tragic counter-revolution. So that's the whole section. It was the bourgeoisie who led the masses in a tragic counter-revolution. Well, you don't see Trotsky's name mentioned in Workers' World anymore. I can't remember if there ever was any controversy over just precisely this aspect, just precisely what form it would take. The old man dealt with it, Trotsky dealt with it. He even projected, you know, the possibility of a split into the bureaucracy. the different wings of the bureaucracy. I mean, I think in the Revolution Betrayed, you characterize them by the different representatives in the bureaucracy itself. Essentially, the question is whether it could be done peacefully or not. Nobody, I don't think they have ever defended the concept that it could be done peacefully, that it's through reform. It has to be overthrown. Now, in April 15th, 1960, that is a year later, isn't it? March, yeah, a year later, on the question of Cuba, they had an article called The Class Conscious Worker's Guide to Cuba, in a form of a question and answer. Now, one question is, what is the class character of the Castro regime? Answer: it is a bourgeois nationalist regime. What's that? Answer: a bourgeois nationalist regime is one in which a colonial country struggles for national independence but does not struggle against capitalism. Question: is Castro for capitalism? Answer: yes. Question: how can the U.S. workers help Cuba? Answer: first duty is to expose U.S. imperialism as the main enemy of both U.S. workers and Cuban workers. Mobilize American workers to stop U.S. intervention in Cuba. Question: but isn't this the same as telling workers that Castro is 100% okay? Answer: no. Along with our defense of revolutionary Cuba against Wall Street, we patiently explain the real situation to the workers. We show that Castro is not basically different from Nehru, Castine, Nasser, and Sukarno. Parenthesis: although he has been compelled to go further than they, but along the same lines. In each of the above cases, the United States capitalists first called a new man a communist, but later accommodated themselves to the new regime as the communists were shunted aside. Question: but can't the Castro regime evolve into a communist one? Answer: there is absolutely no example in history of a bourgeois nationalist regime automatically transforming itself into a workers' state. The road is strewn with the tragic victims of this false theory. That's us, you see. One after another of these bourgeois national regimes first befriended, then slaughtered the workers. Chiang Kai-shek once led an even more violent anti-imperialist revolution than Castro. China, 1925-27. He and his party, the Kuomintang, were formally affiliated to the Communist International as a sympathizing party. This did not prevent Chiang from turning viciously against communists and setting up a capitalist landlord dictatorship. More recently, Nasser literally climbed to power on the shoulders of the most militant workers and soldiers. Now he imprisons, tortures communists and their sympathizers, as explained by Khaled Baghdadi, General Secretary of the Syrian CT. Now, this was April 15, 1960. Several weeks later, if you remember, the question of oil. Remember the oil, the Soviets shipped oil to Cuba, and then the oil companies refused to refine the oil, and the Cubans took over the refinery. Now, this then transformed the whole character of the Cuban state, because by virtue of the fact that they had entered into these relations with the Soviet Union, they became part of the Soviet class camp, and therefore earned the accolade of workers say. Although, never since this time have they come out with their position on Cuba. That is, how they define its class character and why they define it as they do. I assume now they consider it a working state because they consider it in part of the workers' class camp. Well, I'm just trying to point out is how these schematic blueprint approaches to history lead people into the most ludicrous conclusions. So, they had their criteria, and when the Cubans conformed to their criteria, then they, of course, all this was dropped, all this business about never, never, never can, in history, can any bourgeois nationalist state transform itself. This is the quintessence of revisionism, as our friend Healy would say, which next to Pabloism, the most deadly disease known to man. Well, then, as I say later, then they dropped, not only did they drop Lenin and Trotsky from the masthead, but then they dropped any mention of Trotsky at all, and they ceased to have any political identity. I follow this, reading the paper. I usually read it along with a lot of other things that come in for years, and you just cannot determine what they are, what tendency they represent in the working class movement. Never any reference to Trotsky. And so along with that, there appeared one time a group called Youth Against War and Fascism. Now, what is Youth Against War and Fascism? Nobody seems to know. Do they have a political physiognomy? Do they have an identity? They deny it. I, a few weeks ago, was looking in on television. The Gogglebox, as our British cousins would say. And had one of their picket lines on 14th Street, Marine Center, or some Army Marine Center on 14th Street. And one of the commentators interviewing one of them, and he asked him, he says, what is this Youth Against War and Fascism, this group? He said, well, we're just youth, we're against war and fascism. So he says, are you socialists? He says, that's irrelevant. We're against war and fascism, and we're here to protest against war and fascism. And that's what you'll find from that. That not only do they deliberately conceal their identity, but deny that they have that they are socialists of any kind. Now, what they, I don't know. Maybe this is some very brilliant tactical scheme, like the class global class camp thing, that somehow you're going to get a, I don't know what youth are for war and fascism, there's very few, that you're going to get all these youth who are against war and fascism together, and then suddenly they're going to find themselves, well, I don't know what. Because as I say, you can't, well, they'll find themselves for Mao. Now he's for Mao. He's all out for Mao and Maoism. For the past year or two, they've seized upon every major development in order to raise a hue and cry about fascism. It seems to be a sort of a pathological, instead of a political, phenomena. I remember when the Kennedy assassination, they came out with six screening articles about fascism was on the order of the day, but this was the beginning of the attempt of the fascists to take over. Now, if you just take, say, this program in their issue number one, in which they spelled out where they stand, calls for return to the road of Lenin and Trotsky. And let me quote Marcy's, a big full-page article by Sam Marcy, July 2nd, 1964, this past July, on Johnson and Goldwater. in which we had already announced our candidate. Here's his conclusion. The formidable menace of neo-fascist reaction should offer the best opportunity to invigorate the progressive forces and unite them on a nonpartisan, independent program calculated to advance the general interests of the working class as a whole, the cause of the liberation struggle, with the overall objective of fighting anti-war, anti-imperialist struggle against U.S. monopoly capitalism. Now, can anybody be against that? Or can anybody tell me what it means? Now, this is a tortuous way to avoid the question of where do you stand on the D. Barry Shaw candidacy, and sort of a general formula for all good progressives to get together, so long as we agree on a nonpartisan program, of course, agree to advance the general interests of the working class and the liberation struggle with the overall effect. Now, that's a thumbnail sketch of the Marcyites as I know them. They've long ago abandoned holding any kind of meetings. They used to hold a meeting occasionally under the auspices of Workers' World, the parent organization. They've given up. So far as I know, they hold no actions or activities under the name of the organization. It's all under the broad, all-encompassing jurisdictional banner of the Youth Against War and Fascism.
They hold demonstrations in their own name in Buffalo all the time.
In Buffalo?
Oh, yeah. They just held one last week on Vietnam, about 20 people
for that. Of Workers' World?
Yes.
You sure it wasn't Youth Against War and Fascism or the Buffalo Mothers?
I'm sure it was Workers' World and Youth Against War and Fascism. Of course, Youth Against War and Fascism is only about six people. But Workers' World, it's Milton Iverson and Marianne Weissman. They do a lot of stuff in their own name. They put out their own papers.
Yeah, they may in Buffalo. I'm just talking about here. I don't know what they're doing up there. Very interesting.
They also,
now, don't ask me why they do it. I don't know.
They refer to themselves when I got...
Do they still consider themselves Trotsky?
That's what I was going to say. When I was speaking to them, and they asked me where I was, and I mentioned the YSA, and then they finally said, they brought some of their kids into the from New York to participate in the picket line. And they came over to me and said, Jeff, you see those kids over there? Those are real shots here. That was their designation.
Who said that to you?
That was Marianne Weissman, who was one of the leadership.
Oh.
They referred to their young people as the real shots here. The real officers.
Well, you'd never tell us by reading their paper, because they don't have a paper. That's,
I continue to ask them on that, what their position was.
I get the impression that they deliberately seek to try and quarantine their people from any contact with us. At one time, they used to like these other little, like the Wolfers and Robertson used to appear here and pass out their stuff. But they absolutely they haven't done that for a long, long time. Attempt to isolate them, because naturally they're going to run into trouble. I imagine they're getting kids who are against war and fascism, you see. And they don't want them talking politics to any other tendency, because it becomes very embarrassing. It becomes very embarrassing for them.
In the last days of the party, the YSA was founded. Marquette took the fight into the YSA in December 1958.
Oh, yeah.
Going
where?
Going to the factory.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
As soon as they left the SWC, they came to the Senate and used to switch their line, concentrated on state policy. So they just used the demagogy about the two side moves to try to make legal the state to be left.
When they operated in Buffalo, they the Workers' World back. They operated this really anti-fascist group. They carried these signs with bloody daggers, kicking in Negroes' dress, and
Well, you see, once you get that kind of an organization, then you've got to find fascism and fascism all over. Otherwise, there's no reason for your existence. So everything becomes, you know, the threat of fascism is seen in everything. It's seen in Goldwater, it's fascism, and the Kennedy assassination, that's the advent of fascism.
But the youth group is the opposite. You had some of the adults working with the youth group, and I made some mistake one time participating in a meeting that Marianne Weissman was at, and I mentioned the work as well, and she moved tremendously afterwards. Luckily, I didn't say, well, you're in work as well. It's tough to make the moment.
Don't even breathe. He is a caricature of what the Stalinists used to do in the period before 30-40. They would have these, in fact, they had a League Against War and Fascism. That was one of the Stalinist organizations. But these were peripheral organizations, or what they called front organizations. And they would have them one after another. That is, they would have an organization, they would get a lot of innocents in who were against war and fascism, and find out that they were in the Communist Party, more or less. In other words, that all other tendencies were excluded. And so then they'd have to form another organization in order to repeat the process. You're casting out a wide net. You can't develop revolutions on that basis. Kibitzers, yes, but no. And they pick up some good kids who could be otherwise. But for a revolutionary party to conceal its identity, which is the one thing you have, I mean, your press, your meeting, establishes your identity. Here's what you are, who you are, and what you stand for. And say, join us on that basis. Instead of joining something that you don't even know what the hell it is, and then you find that the moment your back is turned, a tag is printed. That doesn't make you a revolutionary, doesn't make you a socialist, doesn't make you anything. So they found out. TL does the same thing, or they started it. I don't see they haven't formed a new organization since the May 2nd committee, have they? Well, that's a legitimate organization. That's a defense organization. I mean, isn't that a defense organization to defend some people that they've got arrested? Oh, it's not a, I thought it was a defense organization. Well, then what is Surge, what is that? That doesn't conform to the committee to aid.
You take the inside leg.
Yeah, it must be like the Madison Avenue. See, Madison Avenue, they discovered that the names of products are easier to remember if they begin with a K.
Right.
See? Like Kleenex. Many products, others that you can think of that I can't think of offhand. But I begin with K. And so a lot of the, I remember a study of this pencil, a lot of these get manufactured again, spelling the many things that should be spelled here with a K. But it's easier to remember. Maybe this thing, Surge, maybe some, it's easier to remember Surge. Sort of a association with Blue Surge, or Surge Forward. Or surge ahead, or a surge yourself. Well, it's exactly 6 o'clock, Bensie. Now, just before we adjourn, I'm sort of at a loss, this business about discussing these things. Is there anything that you want to discuss? I have no objection discussing any aspect in the history of the movement, if I know what you have on your mind. I don't want to discuss just things that I try to guess. See, this business, just I think Jack happened to mention to me that a lot of the comrades were wondering who these people are, what they...
Well, yesterday they had come
to get hold one of their pre-convention documents. They're supposed to have a convention in Easter weekend. And we got hold of one of their pre-convention documents that has some of their statements on it. The very funny thing about I got hold of a little mimeograph sheet called Hammer and Steel, which was the original pro-Maoist group here. It seems to be a lot of competition between the two. And they go after P.L. Hammer and Tong. Just let me... Let me read just a few things. Can I have 5 minutes, Betsy? Okay. All right, here's what they say. They say... They flay progressive labor hip and thigh. The progressive labor started out with a statement that they wanted no fratricidal war with the Trotskyites and the CPSU. I don't remember any such statement. Here again, Rosen and the Trotskyites jointly organized a number of youths to travel to Cuba. Here again, in practice, Rosen unites with the U.S. Trotskyites who peddled State Department trash on Hungary, on Stalin, in support of CISA. Here is really the knee plus ultra. And one of the reasons that they just read T.L. out of the revolutionary movement altogether. Some conclusions they say on that they draw. The reason for PL's existence they say is that U.S. imperialism needs revisionism, produces and cultivates it. Then we must have contempt for U.S. imperialism strategically, respect and guard against it tactically. You get it? You don't, huh? Well, neither do I. But anyway, if you can't do that, you are just a hopeless revisionist, I'm afraid. And so forth and so on. Anyway, according to them, TL has no future at all. The people who really have the future, I'll just let you in on it, are Antithesis on the West Coast and the Ad Hoc Committee for a Marxist-Leninist Party in the Midwest, and Hammer and Steel in the East. And Hammer and Steel has just formed an organization called the New England Party of Labor. Yeah? All right, this is the inside dope on what's going on. I thought I was telling you something new.